So we'll turn the meeting over to Donnell at this time.
Hello, everybody. My name is Donnell, and I'm an addict.
Hey, Donnell.
We said hi already, didn't we? And I'll be honest with you. You know, this isn't what I expected. But this is what I like.
Can you speak up?
Certainly. I was sharing that this is not what I expected, but this is more of what I like. This is the first time I've ever been invited to speak at a convention, you know, and I had it all up in my head that this is going to be, like, really scary and all that, and it's going to be a crowd of people, and it's going to be, like, I had to speak this profound way, and I had to, like, you know, but the thing about it is I come in here tonight, and since I've been in recovery, I've always liked small meetings, you know, and it's just the nature of my recovery. I got my best help out of small meetings like this, you know, at a small intimate meetings, you know, and today I was feeling so emotional because I've met so many people since coming to Narcotics Anonymous. And so many people remembered me. People remembered my name. People remembered parts of my story. It's parts that I couldn't even remember, you know, and the fact that this was the best thing that's happened to me in my life. You know, Narcotics Anonymous has truly, you know, changed who I am. You know, I'm going to say before I started using, you know, I always knew I had a problem. I grew up in Queens, man, New York. And I remember as a little kid, man, there was this one TV commercial about Lay's potato chips. And the commercial used to ask or suggest that, I bet you can't eat just one. You know, and I remember when this commercial came on, I really like Lay's potato chips, you know, and it just behooved me to understand why would anybody want to eat just one good potato chip, you know. And I remember playing this game, so I thought that, well, I bet you that I can eat just one, and I would try to eat just one potato chip, because if I eat just one potato chip, then I can have a few more potato chips left over, and I don't have to keep asking my mother for money to buy potato chips. And I remember it was like a long time that I tried to eat just one potato chip, you know, and I got some friends together, and I betted them that my potato chips would last longer than yours, and we had this thing going on. But I'll never forget that it was impossible for me to eat one potato chip, because they were delicious, you know, and I love them today. You know, but to move on, you know, that was what I realized today, is that was my first indication that I might be an addict, you know. And what happened, you know, later on in life as I was growing up, there was addicts in my household. There's people that used dope. There's people that nodded, you know, my brother and my sister, bottom line. And they used to scare me when I used to see them nod and do what I call the hat trick. And my mother used to say, you should never do that. And she says, you stay away from that activity. And there was addicts up the block on the corner. We were in like a middle-class neighborhood, Corona. And there were addicts always up on Northern Boulevard. And when we would go shopping or coming from flushing or something, we would see all these addicts out there. And she would say, you should never be like these people. You know, those are bad people. You know, and I didn't know the difference between good and bad, but she said that those type of people were bad, you know. And so I said, I will never, ever want to be like those people. You know, I said, I will never want to be like a wino or be like those addicts or be like the bad people. And I remember holding to my heart that, you know, those people use substances, or she said they use dope or whatever they use, and she said they're sick. And I said, I'll never do that. You know, I don't want to be like that. I was comfortable with who I was. You know what I mean? I was comfortable with the innocence that I was raised up until about the third grade. And I remember in about the third grade, there was this girl. Her name was Marilyn Cook. You know, and at that age, I don't know anything about women or relationships or anything like that, but this girl was really cute. And I remember our father had moved out the house by this time, and we were getting poorer and poorer, and we moved into a smaller apartment building. She lived in a big house, but I was encouraged by all my other friends, you know, to get a girlfriend, or and that's what they were doing. And I remember I finally got the courage to ask Marilyn Cook, and she said no. You know, and I remember from that day on, man, that something was wrong with Darnell. Something was wrong with the way my family was raised. They would, all of a sudden, things started becoming wrong. And I started looking at me, and I realized that I was black. I realized I had a big nose. I realized all kind of crazy stuff that I didn't like. That's why Marilyn said no, you know, but But I remember I just went on with life, man. And as I got older, man, and we got poor, we moved to Queensbridge, which is a project. And the addicts that I used to see and the behavior I used to see up on Northern Boulevard was living right in my building now, you know. And when I was in school out in Corona, I was playing the violin, and I wanted to be a doctor, and I was in A classes, and I was just... And I was, like, happy with life, man. But when we moved to Queensbridge, they call those type of people goody-goodies and squares and punks. And there were gangs in Queensbridge. And I remember when we moved to Queensbridge, man, there was a super fear about the way I was raised. And I knew I had to change something. And what I want to share is that, you know, when I do the step work, what I always do is reflect back to a point in my life when it was kind of like reversed. And I remember when we moved to Queensbridge that all of a sudden the peace and serenity that I was living with was a lie. And I told myself that I was being raised to be a punk and that I couldn't trust nobody to raise me anymore. And so what I did was I remember I made a decision. And I'm talking about at maybe age 8, 9, or 10, I made a conscious decision not to listen to any adult. You know, not to listen to my mother, not to listen to anybody who was steering me in a direction that just, you know, was like squarey or punkish or anything like that. And I was still scared because I really wanted to be somebody good, you know, but I just didn't want to be a punk. You know, and I remember I still didn't want to be an addict, and I didn't want to be a bad person, but I was so confused, man. You know, and I remember after making that decision, going out and looking for a friend that I could hang out with, you know, it was a long process because it took a couple of months, and I got into school, and everybody was smoking and drinking beer, and I'm talking about in maybe the sixth grade, man. We used to have to write a note. Early in the morning when I finally got these friends and we wrote a note to the guy in the corner store telling him that my mother wanted a quart of Old English 800 and he would give it to us, you know, and we would drink it and we would go to school and we would be drunk. And I remember my first drunk, I didn't like it at all, but what I do remember that it made it easier for me to behave in a manner in which that I just didn't like. Like hanging out and cussing and spitting, and all of that was taking practice. But the more I drank, the better I got, you know. And it was at one point, I remember I was in a gang in New York, and we was in this gang called the Young Sinners, you know. And I ain't never fought a lick in my life. But we were on a train on the way up to the South Bronx to fight some other gang, man. And we had these knives and sticks and all this other stuff. And what I really want to share is that, you know, I was really scared, man. But the more I drank and the more I used marijuana, whatever drugs did, you know, they just made me more comfortable and they made that fear go away, you know. Eventually I started realizing I really didn't like that lifestyle, you know, and so I started using more and more. You know, I didn't even like really marijuana except it made me laugh sometimes. But what I started doing was getting into other drugs, man. I started taking pills. I started sniffing dope. Again, I'm super afraid of needles, so I never attempted to shoot up any dope. you know, and what I did was I kept using different drugs until I went into the Army. I got out the Army, and then when I got when I was in the Army, my disease spiraled. It got more out of control. They kicked me out the Army, and I thought they kicked me out the Army because they just didn't like me. But bottom line was I couldn't stop using, you know, and I still didn't see myself with the disease of addiction. I didn't think I had a problem. You know, when I got to New York, I couldn't get a job right away. And what happened was this movie Scarface came out. Crack wasn't out yet, but people were freebasing. I wanted to get another lifestyle. And after I saw Scarface, like, I couldn't get a job. So I said, well, maybe I could sell some drugs. You know, and I started selling cocaine, and people wanted it cooked up. And at this time, I'm still just smoking weed and drinking a little bit. But I remember we were making a lot of money, and I couldn't figure out why people were coming back to me like 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. They were spending all their money, and I was making a lot of money. But I remember telling myself that these people, you know, These must be real addicts. They got to be foolish, man, to be selling their food stamps and all this stuff. And I remember telling myself, there's nothing that can control a person like that, you know. And then the Richard Pryor incident happened, and he got burnt up for freebasing. And it was like, you know what, even famous people are doing that. You know, I know I could do this. And I said, you know, that these people are weak, you know. But I wanted to see what was making them drive like that, you know, and it took one hit, y'all, and I could tell you, man, after taking that hit, I remember making another decision, man, and that decision was based on the fact that I knew that I was going to be smoking this for as long as I live, you know, and I said, well, I might be an addict because I'm going to use it every day. I might be develop a habit or something, but what I'm going to do, I sat down with a pen and piece of paper, and I wrote down some mathematical equations as to if I smoke a dime a day, that would be $70, and I would be able to do that and commence to do whatever else I was doing at the time. And that seemed like a great idea, man. You know, I mean, it really did. And I'm going to tell you, for almost 15 years, I tried to smoke a dime a day. You know? I tried every which way. I tried smoking it first and drinking, and drinking first and smoking. And it just never, I mean, it just spiraled out of control, man. I left New York City because I really didn't hit the bottom in New York, but I just got tired of smoking, you know, because it was like free limits. I was still making a lot of money, and I was just smoking too much. I got tired of it, and I said, I have to leave this lifestyle, because people started shooting at me then, and my mother was in jeopardy because I was stashing it in her house. And so I said, nah, I gotta go. And there was a house in Baltimore a friend had, and moved down to Baltimore, and I think I stopped smoking crack for 2 years. And then what happened was my drinking went out of control. Then crack found me again in Baltimore. Then I upped again, and I left for Norfolk. And when I got to Norfolk again, I went on a drinking spell for, what, two years again. And I almost died during this drinking spell because we was in a DWI. I mean, we was in a drunk accident. And I was in a coma and all this. And I was on my deathbed. And I remember when I came out the coma, I didn't know my name. I didn't know where I would live. I didn't know anything. And I got in touch with my family. And I was in the hospital for something like 6 months in rehab and all this. And when I first got out the hospital, you know, it was like I almost died in the hospital, as a matter of fact. Because they had to do brain surgery because the clot wasn't going nowhere. And my brother had to sign for my property and all that. And I remember praying with my mother in the hospital. And all of a sudden, they didn't have to do the surgery. The blood clot was leaving, you know. And I was this new saved guy with a new life. And I just was so rejuvenated that I was still alive because people were telling me that you were dying and all this. But 2 days after I got out the hospital, I found myself running to 7-Eleven to get some wine. And I knew something was wrong with that picture, you know. And but I couldn't remember my name. You know, I couldn't remember how to eat. They had to teach me how to eat. You know, I forgot everything, but I remembered how to drink. And 2 weeks later, I decided that Norfolk was too slow and that I needed to move to a bigger, faster city. You know, and I picked up smoking crack again. You know, and I just went at it with a vengeance, man. And I remember when I got to D.C., I started boosting somehow. And, you know, I was a goody-goody. I never had any records or anything. And I got arrested at this place called Tyson's Corner. And I remember it was Fairfax, Virginia. And I remember the judge, you know, asking me, man, you're 27 years old. He asked me, why are you starting this business at 27 years old? You know, and I remember thinking that because I just started smoking crack. You know, and that was in the back of my mind. I didn't answer that, but it had dawned on me that, you know, none of this mess started until you started messing with these drugs. You know what I mean? But still, like I say, you know, he let me go. I did 30 days time, and all hell broke loose in Washington, D.C. I'm talking about going into shelters, which was a bottom, and living in a shelter for 3 years, and still not seeing myself with a problem with the disease of addiction, and thinking that the economic status of the country was my problem, and Reaganomics was my problem, and that even the size of the drugs that I use, if they gave me more for my money, I wouldn't have to go out and cop as much. You know, those were all my problems, you know, and then the boosting was just spiraling. I was going into jail every 30 days, and then I remember finally, you know, that after I got into the shelter, I'm going to tell you, I cried for 2 days. But when I realized I didn't have to pay any rent and I could still smoke my drug of choice, you know, it became okay with me, you know. And I remember, though, it was about the 15th time that I was arrested that the judge said, we don't want you to cop a plea, that you're going to go to trial and you're going to get charged with a felony and that you're facing 20 years, you know. And I remember asking him for one of those programs that I heard a lot about in jail, you know, and what he said was, I'll tell you what, we'll give you one of those programs, but you got to give us 18 clean urines, you know, and I didn't know how to do that, you know, but I remember them telling me that, sending me to a program, and the program sending me to Narcotics Anonymous. You know, and I remember walking into the meetings, and y'all were talking about steps and all of that, and I had no clue of what y'all were talking about when you talked about the steps, but I knew that y'all were talking about a God, and y'all were talking about powers greater than myself, and y'all were talking about me surrendering to something, to the disease of addiction, and I just was clueless. You know, all I wanted to do was stay out of jail, you know, and what I remember is somebody said you could fake it till you make it, and so that's what I did. I stayed around these rooms for like 18 months, man, and I acted as if, you know, the only thing I didn't do was just pick up, man. And it was like the worst 18 months of my using days, man, because I'm going to tell you, man, I had no coping skills. I had no coping mechanisms for life. And what I'm talking about is jobs saying no, buses, late buses, you know, all kind of anything in life that was giving me a problem, man, I didn't not know how to deal with it. And I was just off the hook. But I just did not use. You know, I remember when I got my 18th urine, the PO cut me loose. And when I went back to using, it wasn't a problem, man. I was just waiting for it, you know. And I went back out for 5 more years, you know. But I thank God for those 18 months because after them 5 years, man, my last 24 hours of using was like, it was no longer a physical bottom. It was no longer the shelter. It was no longer the fact that I didn't have a job, but what it was is how I felt on the inside. And I remember walking to this soup kitchen, and the soup kitchen, they had real bums, and then they had people that were using drugs and all this other stuff. And I remember walking past this bag lady. And I remember I used to kind of like just fake it by make myself feel better by shaving my head, shaving my mustache, or doing something to make me feel better, or putting on a clean sweatsuit or something. And I saw this bag lady, and I remember thinking that she's probably doing a hell of a lot better than me, you know, because she didn't just blow $300 last night. you know, and I remember not being able to pick my head up and stare anybody in the eye, any stranger in the eye. And my last 24 hours, I remember I just did not want to use, you know, but the problem was I couldn't stop. It was like I had three green lights. I had three green lights to use. Number one, I was in a rooming house. The landlord didn't want money because I could steal him something. I was on probation. Probation officer didn't want any urine because it was dirty, and he knew it was dirty. And there was security at Hex Department Store. I remember the only way I could get clean was get an oil change was to go into the department store, get arrested, and that's the only way I could stop using. And I wanted to stop using, and I went to that Hex Department Store. I put on a suit. I grabbed the most expensive polo coat or something. Tickets was on it. The alarm was on it. I commenced down the steps, and I remember I saw security go by the door, and I went through the door. The alarm went off, and I stood out there waiting for them to come back and arrest me, and they did not come back. You know, and it was like I had all this drugs, and I had the green light to just smoke my life away. And I remember having chest pains, and I remember sitting in this room, in this rooming house, man, all by myself, and my chest was hurting so hard. I didn't want to smoke no more, but I couldn't stop smoking. And it was like it had dawned on me that, you know what, Darnell, you're about to die. And I remember asking myself, do I really want to die? And I remember the answer was yes. But I was afraid of the pain in my chest. You know, and I remember not being able to drop the stem or pick it up or what to do, you know. And I remember dropping to my knees and praying like I never prayed before. And when I got up off my knees, I remember the only way I stayed clean was through Narcotics Anonymous, when I really didn't want to stay clean, you know. And I went to detox. I've been clean ever since, man. And what I've been doing since I've been here is working the steps. You know, and the steps is what's introduced me to my story. The steps have introduced me to my life. You know, it was a process in getting here. It's a process while I'm here. Like I say, when I first got here, and I really wanted to stay clean, I didn't know that once I put the drugs down that I still had a problem. You know, it took me 30 days and yet another arrest for me to start doing step work. You know, because I was still going into stores at 30 days clean because that's what I enjoyed doing. You know, and then when I got arrested, I realized that I felt the same way using that I did without using. You know, and I almost cried in that jail because they were glad to see me, man. It was like, oh, 88 is back. That was my nickname. Oh, yeah, Darnell is back. 88 is back. And they were happy to see me. And I remember this just awful feeling on the inside, just like the last day that I was using that. And I couldn't figure out why I was feeling this way. You know, and when they cut me loose, I remember going to my first meeting and explaining what happened and asking for a sponsor, you know, and that's where I started my recovery, is when I got that sponsor and we started working on some steps, you know. You know, I'm just glad to be here today, man. It's 7 years later, man. I got a new sponsor and we're working on another cycle of steps, you know. And like I was sharing earlier, man, that you know, I'm still a little nervous, man. But I'm glad to be here, you know, and I'm going to wind it down, okay? And I guess we're going to open up the meeting, and thanks for letting me share.
Thanks for sharing. I guess the meeting is open for everybody who wants to share tonight. All right, now, you know we can't sit. There we go.
Yes, yes sir.
For me, I'm a backslider. The first time around here, I accumulated 2 years clean, a little over 2 years clean, but I didn't work no steps. Mm-hmm. So when a storm came through, it took me right off my foundation. I'm just getting back into the rooms. I had a good sponsor. She's back in my life today, as of today. And that was my real purpose of coming down here, you know, because I had supportive people in my life when I wasn't using in the beginning that really stuck by me. And I just walked out on everything and everybody, including my kids, you know, abandoned them and being self-centered is what I did. I just gave up on life, period. When I went back, I mused. That's good. It all stemmed from not working on myself the first go around, not getting to, you know, learn how to deal with life on life terms, because I feel as though if I had been working on my steps and stuff when I lost my son in 2002, I probably wouldn't have went on that last run. And that last run just ended. You know, I ended up in an institution for 7 months off a prostitution charge. You know, when they locked me up, I found out that I was pregnant again with my fifth child. My oldest is getting ready to come out of school next month, the 30th of next month. You know, and now I have a new baby, and I'm like, I'm going through a lot because I really never dealt with the issue of losing my son, one of my sons. So, in reality, I'm still in a lot of pain that I need to work on. But the blessing in it all is I got arrested. That's where my help came from, just by being, you know, put in an institution. Because I wasn't going to stop using. I was going to use and use and use until either somebody killed me or, you know, whatever. Because that's the way I felt. I'm just grateful, you know, that God gave me another chance. Because if he didn't, I wouldn't be here. I have a lot of work to do on me, and it's going to take some time and some healing for me to even to begin growing. But I'm willing. I need to get myself back on the right track, and I'm just glad that my sponsor. I have two sponsors now, but I have to use them. You know, I have to use them to survive, because I gave up over the death of my child. So what's going to happen when my mother goes, when my father goes, because they still live? You know, I have to prepare myself, because one day, we were all born to die. One day, they're going to go. And only by the grace of God are my other kids together because of my mother. You know, because they could have been in the system a long time ago if I didn't, you know, if she wasn't here. But I'm just trying to prepare myself for life today. So thanks for letting me share.
Thanks for sharing.
It's come to my attention that if you don't want to be taped, is that correct? Yeah, you don't. He can turn this off while you share. Does anybody else like to share?
I'm sharing.
Okay, hey, Sharon.
Something you said, you know, they said, fake it when until you make it. And I remember when I came in and I heard those things, I didn't know what they were talking about. You know, I mean, I heard fake it till you make it. It's things even today I'm still trying to figure out. Like the other day they were saying, some gotta die for others to live. I said, now, hell in the hell, ain't nobody dying for me. Ain't no addict out in the street dying so I can live. I'll tell you who might be the addicts that's in these rooms that have had all the diseases that we had, that have died clean, you know, and had still chose to
go to meetings, and they be broke down, look like a different person, but they still at the meeting. You know, I've seen that. And I've seen people, you know, that I've asked to be my sponsor. You know, I've had girlfriends that, you know, that I felt like I finally found a friend in here, a real close friend, and then she'll die, you know. And those people, they keep me clean. I mean, if their dying had any purpose at all, which I don't feel like it did, but that would keep me clean. You know, they have that infinity key tag that they give people that die here clean. You know, but not none of them people that they insinuating would die so that I can stay clean. They ain't dying for me. I don't give a damn. You know what I'm saying? My girlfriend that they threw in the trash, my girlfriend that they threw in the woods and all that stuff when I was using, you know, that didn't help me get clean. I just kept right on using. I didn't even know nothing was wrong with it. You know, but I don't understand that. When I saw my old sponsor here, she used to tell me a lot of sayings. She used to say, when you think, Sharon, when you think you're looking bad, you're looking good. And when you think you're looking good, you're looking bad. I said, damn. You know, when I think I'm looking good, I'm looking bad. And vice versa. Now, I can see that they used to say, I can see that somewhat, though. You know, I could, you know. But then they used to say, You could have a castle or a hut in here, Sharon. A castle or a hut. And I got married about 7 years ago. I told my husband, you can have a castle and or a hut in here. And he said, I'm going to have a castle. And he meant a real castle. But I do, inside of me, that's not what it meant to me. You know, you can do one step, like I met a guy, one step. They called him one step in his name, you know. He wanted the hut, you know. That's all he wanted, the one step. I've seen all kind of people, you know, they get the wife or the husband and they leave. You know, that's all they wanted, or the job, or the this, or what they got, you know, whatever they got, and they leave. That's all they wanted, you know. And I say, damn, wonder what it's going to take for me to leave. What is my payoff, you know? What is it gonna make me leave like that? Must be something, must be a price, you know, that I could get that'll make me leave. I wonder what it is. But I'm still figuring out, you know, the things they say here. One thing I couldn't understand too was when they said life on life's terms.
Yes. Good call.
What the hell are you talking about? You know, life on life's terms. Damn. Sometimes I get moments of brilliance where I really know, and then sometimes I'm dumb as a box of rocks again. And I'm going like, life on life's terms. What they talking about? You know, it just comes and it goes. Sometimes for that one. I don't know that one real good. You know, but I'm hanging around here long enough. What really happens is I have an experience that teaches me what that means. You know, like a disease, you know, or I marry a crackhead, you know, or you know, some of the dumb stuff I done, I hit bottom in relationship, you know. Or I decide I'm going to go gambling, you know. Or I get hurt and I try to use up people. You know, I try to go use up some people, you know. And I know that I had that obsessive compulsive and all that behavior that they talk about. But, you know, I just wanted to, when you said that, I just wanted to let somebody know where my head is going with that. you know, that I've heard all these phrases the whole time I've been here. And, you know, and it's been 17 years this month. And I'm still trying to figure it out. And, you know, this ain't a figure-out program. You know, it actually has to be lived, and then you'll know. Sure. Then you'll know. Anyway, that's all I got to shoot.
Thanks for sharing.
Sure.
One more.
My name is Ray. I'm Mac.
Hey, Ray.
I want to thank you for sharing, man, because I can relate to your story a lot. You know, I grew up in a family where I wasn't allowed to the front porch. You know, I lived in an area that was drug infested. My mom didn't want me going there either. And then we moved to a worser area, and I did the same thing you did. Like you said, I made that decision, F the adults. You know what I mean? It was all about me. You know, and I was raised in gangs. You know, and I did some really shitty shit in my lifetime, you know, through my addiction. Recently, man, about 2 weeks ago, I drive trucks. So I did NA meetings all in the 48 continental states, you know. And, so I love NA. You know, I mean, it's always there when I need it, you know. And, I stopped going to the meetings, and I left my higher power back at home. When I was out on the road, I started having drug dreams. Again, you know, after 5 years, man, I thought I'd be done with them. You know, and then I had to go home last week. And I moved back to Pennsylvania from Missouri, and my problem was I was comparing NA in Missouri to NA in Pennsylvania, and there was no way PA was going to match where I got my recovery at. You know, and so I was not open-minded to it. You know, and last week I made the decision to be open-minded when I went to them meetings, you know, and I found out there really is good recovery where I live at in PA. You know, and I've been playing with my addiction a lot lately. Like, damn, I just want to drink one beer. You know, last night my daughter told me if I drink one beer, she'd feed me with a baseball bat. But after I went to that meetings open-mindedly, the drug dreams went away again. You know, and I'm only in now. I didn't even know about this convention until yesterday. Because I'm out on the road so much, you know, my truck broke down in the shop for at least a week, you know. And it's like this morning, I ran into another person in NA, and it was like, let's go down to the convention. You know, they're having one up in Harrisburg, but I didn't want to be around those people. I just wanted to go down here and be around people I don't know. To me, I learn more from people I don't know than people I do know in the rooms. You know, it gives me more attention to listen to them and stuff. I'm glad I came down here, man. You know, I can relate to your story a lot. I'm glad you shared. That's all I got.
Thanks for sharing.
Anybody else?
Hi, my name's George. I'm an addict.
Hey, George.
First of all, I'd like to apologize. I came in here. I thought there was a meeting going on. We were a little loud. I don't know where everyone's from here, but I thought this was a great convention. I had a lot of fun. Still having fun. I got a lot out of it. Today's the 30-day sober day for me, so I got a free book.
Right.
The irony book. But I just want to thank everyone in NA for being there for me, helping me, because it's the best 30 days of my life so far, I think. Thank you.
Thanks for sharing.
Yes, I'm an addict. My name is Cecilia.
Hey, Cecilia.
And first of all, thank God for allowing me to be here today. And for y'all for helping me stay here for this long. Wow, it has really been a great convention. And one of the things I like is I like the topic that the theme that the committee chose, that dreams do come true. I was over at the main meeting, and I had to bring my son back over. We walked over. And just walking over and reflecting on how I started this journey when I came to Ocean City the first time I came, it was 10 of us in a room. I think I had to sleep on the floor. My duffel bag, which was the plastic bag from Food King, with my clothes was in it, was my pillow that night. At that time, they used to charge us to get in the dance. I think it was $5 so I could go to the dance. And I wasn't trying to go with nobody, so I didn't get a date to, you know, I just had what I had. And all I had was my little money that was left over from my welfare check. Well, I'm here to report today that this program has opened up so many doors for me that now, not only did I dream the dream, I'm in the dream.
That's right.
I just go back a little bit. I came off the streets and I used to do services to men for money. And it was sort of hard doing that because I had to get drugs, and that's the only thing I knew how to do, because before all that happened, I could steal real good, but once I hit and geek, I can't steal.
Welcome.
So I had to do it that way. And in this process, I managed to get married and haven't been outside my marriage. All I had was a high school diploma, but the same welfare agency that helped me with the welfare gave me a job called Project Independence, y'all. And I didn't understand. I was like, I'm doing all this work, and they ain't giving me but $60, but God was getting me ready.
Prepare.
Now, that same job I'm sitting on still today, and now my ninth year there, and I supervise 14 other women. Wait a minute, hold up. All I got is a high school diploma, and I was living in my mother's house on a welfare check, and then I got a house. But what happened, I'm talking about all this stuff, y'all, some spiritual stuff had to happen on the inside of me way before I got all those things. Because I had that shit before. Somebody else gave it to me, mm-hmm. or I moved in yours.
That's right.
But what happened along the way, and on top of that, something said to me, you know what, I always wanted a degree. Always. And at 1:33 yesterday, I typed my very last paper to my master's degree.
All right.
My dreams, you know what I'm saying? I want to take a building like this, and I don't want to do what, and then I don't want to exclude anybody, but I don't want to go and borrow no money so nobody can put no comas and no stipulations on what I can do, but I want to build a building built for me where people can come and I can help them, and I can hire people to come in and work in there and help other people out. One of the things I learned here since I've been here, that this is a program of behavior change.
Mm-hmm.
I went to school to learn how to help people change their behavior. Mm-hmm. I'm hitting something here. Mm-hmm. God is good. Because when I got here, my behavior was a mess. Now what I have taken that mess to do, and y'all told me to do this, so if I'm wrong, y'all help me out. Y'all told me to take all of my negatives and turn them into a positive.
Mm-hmm.
I ain't stealing from myself no more. I ain't stealing from the government. I ain't using nothing I ain't supposed to be using. I overeat because that's something that I like, and I haven't learned how to manage that. Y'all told me that I was going to be unmanageable somewhere. I'm going to try real hard to work on that this year because I want it. The other part of this fall is the physical of this process. I want to get the physical part now. But when I stopped smoking in this process, nobody told me to exercise. Because I'm a real smart addict, real smart. I can figure everything out except the shit I need to do for me. That's the stuff. I can figure out how to do everything for you, but I can't figure out how to do nothing for Cecilia. You know, I'm just so grateful that, and I heard somebody over there shared they had on $800 this, and everybody was dressed up so nicely, and it was all so remarkable. And when I was packing up, I got this big old suitcase, and really ain't nobody looking at all that. The people that hugged me, my heart touched their heart. The hug, the reason why the hug when I first got here, they said the reason why we hug the way we hug is so that your heart can actually touch another's heart and you can feel the beat. And that's what they told me, and I believe that. So they actually taught me, as a female, how to hug the men. Because you know, I didn't know that I wanted to hug like that, right? But they said, no, it's a real way to hug around here. The women in this process, I started out calling those very beautiful women, those very beautiful creatures, queens, you hear me? Bitches and all that. Those same bitches have saved my life.
Mm-hmm.
They know, they said, thank you for calling us that, but just keep coming back. I think this program has allowed me to show up and be me. Even when I was crazy. Y'all said, just come on in here and be crazy. It's all right. But when I was sad, y'all said, come on in here and cry. It's all right. When I ran out of crack, they put me out. They put me out. They ain't tell me come back now unless I had some damn room. I'm going to sit down. Because when I hit, stuff be coming and and I got to move around so anybody want to get high with me. You know, I lost a lot of friends out there. And everybody here that has said they was my friend along the way, God has saw fit to have them still somewhere touching my spirit. I'm just so filled up and happy. I really am happy. This thing was really blowing out. I remember when we could get in the convention center and all the back seats was empty. And today, it was nothing, not even standing room in there. And that's God. That is God. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Thanks for